This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, you can't really understand the controversy about the taking down of these Confederate monuments unless you understand the Civil War. We'll speak today with Professor Bruce Carlin Levine, an historian of the Civil War, about the meaning of the taking down of these statues. We speak with law professor Ellen Yaroshevsky, who teaches ethics at the Hofstra University Law School, about President Trump's pardoning of Sheriff Joe Arpaio. Arpaio was an early Trump supporter. This is the payback.
Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Stephen Smith.
And I'm New York City attorney and activist Heidi Boghossian.
The American Civil War, fought between 1861 and 1865, killed more Americans than all other wars combined. 600,000 Americans died in a war that was fought over whether slavery was to be abolished in the United States. The head Confederate general, Robert E. Lee, owned an 1,100-acre plantation in Virginia and 60 slaves. The value of a slave in today's dollars was at that time $35,000 a person. Jefferson Davis, the president of the Confederacy, owned a 1,400-acre cotton plantation in Mississippi. The institution of slavery was enormously profitable and led to the establishment of America as a leading capitalist power in the world. Slavery was supported in the South not just by the slave owners themselves, but by many white persons who, by virtue of their skin color, saw themselves as superior to blacks. It was widely believed that black people were inferior to white people, both intellectually and morally. Lincoln issued the Revolutionary Emancipation Proclamation in 1863, freeing the Southern slaves. This can be considered the Second American Revolution. The slaves began taking up arms and fighting against the slave owners. In the wake of the Civil War, a biracial democratic republic was established in the South. This second American Revolution was overthrown shortly thereafter when the Northern capitalists and politicians made a deal with the ex-slave owners in the South. Union troops, which were supporting the black population, were withdrawn. Thereafter, a system of Jim Crow segregation was instituted, and blacks were nearly re-enslaved and used as landless sharecroppers or prison laborers. Segregation was re-established and enforced by massive terror by whites against blacks. The Ku Klux Klan was founded, and 4,000 people were lynched in events carried out before the white public who assembled in crowds to watch. Statues of Southern generals like Robert E. Lee and monuments to the Confederacy were erected, not after the Civil War, but many years later to reinforce Jim Crow and combat the civil rights movement of the 50s. We speak today with Civil War historian and University of Illinois Professor Emeritus Bruce Carlin Levine. His latest book, titled Fall of the House of Dixie, is widely appreciated as one of the best books on the Civil War. Bruce Levine has taught history at the University of California and the University of Illinois. He's now writing a book for Simon & Schuster about the radical Republican leader during the Civil War era, Thaddeus Stevens. Professor Bruce Levine, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you, Michael, for having me on.
It's a pleasure, Bruce. Why do you call the Civil War America's Second Revolution?
Well, I should say that I'm hardly the first person to call it that. People were calling it that at the time of the Civil War, and they were calling it that as well in years afterwards. And in the 20th century, Charles and Mary Beard, who were probably the best-known historians in the country between the World Wars, revived that term. But I think it's very appropriate. If by revolution we mean something that radically transforms the nature of life in a society, then I believe the American Civil War deserves that name, revolution, even more than what we refer to as the American Revolution. Because as a result of this war, 4 million human beings who had been owned as property were now legally free. The same war took the Southern elite, those who had dominated political life in the South, but also dominated political life in the United States as a whole for most of the period prior to the Civil War. It first of all stripped them of the most valuable property that they owned, namely slaves, the property that defined them as a social class. So in sociological terms, this war destroyed the Southern ruling class as a social class. And it took away from them the political power that they had exercised over the United States. All three branches of the federal government had been in Southern hands for most of the period between the first American Revolution and 1861. And thereafter, that was no longer true. Half a century was going to pass then before a man born in the South was going to sit in the White House again or preside over the United States Senate, which they had often done prior to the war. And the Supreme Court, which had previously been dominated by Southerners, remained in the hands of non-Southerners. And control of the federal government rested, instead of being in the hands of slaveholders and the allies of slaveholders, the federal government was now in the hands of people who represented the interests of an entirely different part of the country and a different kind of society, northern-based manufacturing and commercial society. So this fits my definition, at least, of a revolution. Is a radical change in the country's history.
So what do you say to people who assert that the Civil War was not fought over slavery, but over states' rights, and it was really a noble cause?
Well, let's start off with whether it was fought over slavery. The tiny kernel of truth in that claim is that the North did not enter the war under the banner of abolishing slavery. But that's about the limit of the value of that claim, because what had triggered the war, of course, was the withdrawal from the Union of most of the slave states in 1860 and 1861. And they had left the Union by their own testimony precisely to save slavery, because an anti-slavery party and its leader had taken over, or was about to take over, control of the executive branch of the federal government. And in his two inaugural addresses in 1861 and 1865, Abraham Lincoln said in so many words that slavery had caused the Civil War.
Why do you think that the Civil War is often called the irrepressible conflict?
Well, it's called the irrepressible conflict. I think the first person who used this term was William Seward, the man who became Abraham Lincoln's Secretary of State. It was an irrepressible conflict in the sense that no matter how hard they tried, and political leaders in the United States tried very hard between the drafting of the Constitution and the outbreak of the Civil War, tried very, very hard to muffle this issue, to bury the issue of slavery, to silence the dispute over the validity and legality of slavery, and they just could not do it. It was too powerful an issue. It was too salient a question, and despite multiple attempts to bury it, silence it, compromise it, paper it over, it kept forcing its way back into the center of political life until it finally triggered the war and revolution that we're talking about.
Why did Southerners who were not slave owners support the Civil War?
Well, there are a variety of reasons. Let's start off by making clear who's who and what's what. By 1860, one quarter of all white families in the slave states actually owned slaves. And a little simple arithmetic tells us that that means three-quarters of white families did not. But that doesn't mean that three-quarters of the white white families of the South were unconnected to slavery. Some rented slaves. Some borrowed slaves. Many aspired to become slave owners. Others, many others, had become convinced precisely by the slave owners and their propagandists that only slavery could keep the black population of the South down, could keep them in a position of enforced inferiority. And so most whites in the South had been sold a bill of goods, according to which their own rights, their own economic status, such as it was, depended on keeping the black population down. And so they had been told, and most of them believed, that the end of slavery would harm their interests directly or indirectly. We know this from all sorts of places, the fact that non-slaveholders regularly elected slaveholders and pro-slavery politicians to office throughout the pre-Civil War era.
What role did black people in the South play in their own emancipation?
Well, they played multiple and important roles in that emancipation. It was a palpable fact that black people resented, to put it mildly, slavery that helped stimulate the rise of the anti-slavery movement elsewhere. Had enslaved people been as docile and satisfied with their condition as pro-slavery writers claimed they were, it would have been much more difficult to mount a campaign against slavery, a campaign that accelerated in the 1830s and grew steadily stronger down to the 1860s. But even more dramatically, of course, is the fact that once war began, black people played major roles in supporting and eventually joining and directly strengthening the Union Army. Men and women who had managed to escape from slavery during the war labored on behalf of the Union Army. And by the end of the war, nearly 200,000 black men, most of them recruited from slave states, served in the Union Army or Navy. And Abraham Lincoln repeatedly said that without this assistance, it would have been impossible to win the war.
Because now that we've established what the war was all about, let's talk about what the taking down of these statues and monuments to the Confederacy is all about. Let me ask you about the head Southern General Robert E. Lee. Is it more accurate to say that he fought a noble cause for the rights of states in the South, or that he was a slave owner who supported slavery and fought to keep it?
I think, you know, it's impossible to separate these two facts. He did indeed believe in states' rights, but it's also important to recognize, as more than one Southerner said, that the doctrine of states' rights was really simply the armor that encased and protected the institution of slavery. Southern leaders didn't care at all about local control when federal power could preserve slavery. And there were instances such as the Fugitive Slave Law in which federal power overrode local and states' rights in the name of protecting slavery, and of course, slave owners were all for that. And slave owners also tried to impose from the federal government pro-slavery code in all the federal territories, regardless of the wishes of those who lived in those territories. So when states' rights was upheld, it was when slave owners felt it was necessary to protect slavery against possible interference by politicians in Washington. Robert E. Lee claimed to join the Confederacy simply to protect his state of Virginia, but of course Robert E. Lee had married into a large slaveholding family, owned many slaves, emancipated those slaves only because his deceased father-in-law had required him to do so in his will. Lee's often given credit for having voluntarily emancipated those slaves, and that's simply not true. And Lee made clear in a series of letters that he considered slavery to be the ideal relationship between black and white people. So I think it's both the case that he fought the war as a slave owner and as a defender of states' rights, because they're really one and the same thing.
What about the statue of Robert E. Lee being the focus point of the demonstrations in Charlottesville? When was that statue erected? And isn't it true that the majority of statues like this and other monuments to the Confederacy were not erected right after the Civil War, but were erected for the purpose of supporting Jim Crow later, or for the purpose of supporting the resistance to the Civil Rights Movement in the 50s?
Well, exactly right, Michael. It's my understanding that there are about 1,500 publicly supported monuments and memorials to the Confederacy in public places, and of those, more than 700 are actual monuments and statues to the Confederacy. Robert E. Lee is a favorite of these statue makers because after the Civil War, Confederate generals and Confederate politicians got together quite deliberately and explicitly to try to resurrect the reputation of the Confederacy and to depict Robert E. Lee as the symbol of the Confederacy and to strip him of his association with slavery. And so the Confederate statues were part of an attempt to refurbish, to polish up, to clean up the reputation of the slaveholding republic that had been defeated in 1865. And this was an attempt not only to honor the Confederacy, but also to assert the continuing subordination of black people, even once slavery had ended legally. And so you see the peak period of construction of these Confederate monuments happening, first of all, between about 1895 and 1920, when Jim Crow was really taking finished form, and again between about 1955 and 1965, at the height of the early mid-century civil rights movement. These statues were an assertion on the part of supporters of white supremacy that they intended to continue the subordination of black people.
We're speaking with retired Professor Bruce Carlin Levine, who has written the great book about the Civil War, in my opinion, called Fall of the House of Dixie. And we're speaking with him about the controversy over the monuments to the Confederacy that are being removed. Bruce, how do you answer the preservationists who argue that these monuments reflect our history and should not be removed?
Well, Michael, of course, monuments are not needed in order to remember history. Somebody said recently that those who worry about the erasure of history as the result of the removal of monuments will be delighted to learn that there are such things as books. People do not, in the first place, learn about history because there's a statue staring at them. Statues are things that, generally speaking, we pass by, we see day after day, and move on, and few of us, I think, inquire very deeply about what they actually represent. Statues are not history lessons. Statues are celebrations. They are affirmations. They are statements about what in the past is worth revering. And the absence of statues speaks just as loudly to what those in control of the land think is not worth revering. So in order, for example, to remember the Civil War, you don't need to erect a statue of Robert E. Lee. And if you do, this tells us a good deal about how you feel about that war and who you think were the heroes of that war. So, for example, in order to remember the American Revolution, why don't we have a statue of Benedict Arnold or any number of British imperial generals? Because that's not whom we revere. Neither the traitors nor the imperial forces that attempted to suppress the American Revolution. By the same token, we do not need monuments that distort and are designed to distort the history that really was in the minds of people living.
To put a finer point on your point about the absence of monuments, there were 16 black men who served either in the House of Representatives or the Senate subsequent to the Civil War. Are there any monuments to those people?
Well, I'm not an expert on that, Michael, so I could be wrong, but I know of no such monuments. Nor do I know of hundreds of monuments to the hundreds of thousands of men, black men, who served in the Union Army. I know of one in particular in Boston dedicated to the 54th Massachusetts Colored Infantry Regiment. And if there are others, there aren't many others, and I suspect they aren't found in the states of the former Confederacy at all.
Really? The South, right after the Civil War, could be described as a biracial democracy. There were literacy drives, there were integrated legislatures, there were unions that were formed, and all of this, I think, is been wiped over by the racists, and none of that is generally known by the American population. Trump made the slippery slope argument that if we remove statues of Robert E. Lee and Stonewall Jackson, logically we should then remove statues of Thomas Jefferson and George Washington. What is your response to that?
Well, Thomas Jefferson and George Washington are not my ideals of national leaders. But the statues that have been erected in their name are not erected in order to assert the legitimacy and the value of the slavery in which they participated. They're erected despite their having been slave owners, not because they were slave owners. Right now, the struggle is to bring down statues that deliberately consecrated slavery and a society based on slavery. And so people always raise this kind of slippery slope argument in order to change the subject. We need to keep our eyes on the prize and recognize that there is major value in supporting people who are attempting to remove living symbols that stand for oppression. By the way, let me just throw in that some people have said we shouldn't waste time in struggles to remove these symbols. We should be instead fighting for practical means to do away with white supremacy. And in my opinion, these two things are not, in fact, separate or separable. The struggle against the symbols and the consecration of white supremacy are an integral part of raising the spirit and the self-confidence of people who are fighting in practical ways to do away with white supremacy in all aspects of American life.
Well, that leads me to a penultimate question here, Bruce. If the American Civil War was the second American Revolution, what would the third American Revolution look like?
Well, if there's to be a third American Revolution, I would expect it would be a revolution once again to transform the nature of American life in a fundamental manner. And in this case, of course, it would be a revolution to overturn capitalism, to overturn the control of the economy and indirectly of the government by the 1% or the one half of 1% and replace it with a society in which everything that makes life possible is democratically controlled by the people and where the government is genuinely controlled by the people. That, I would expect, would be the heart of any third American revolution that could occur. I have to add that I don't see this anywhere on the horizon, but I think that would be the way it would occur, should it occur.
We're now in the year 2017. It's the 100th anniversary of the Great Russian Revolution. And I wanted to ask you how you feel about the city of Leningrad being renamed Petrograd and about all these statues of Lenin being torn down in the former Soviet Union?
Well, I feel ambivalent about all of that. The renaming of Russian cities, not only Leningrad, but a number of others from their former name, St. Petersburg and then Petrograd, was not something that, if I remember correctly, the Bolshevik Party, in the best years of the Russian Revolution, sought. They were things done in the era of the revolution's decay and degeneration by Joseph Stalin, who incidentally renamed the city after himself while he was still alive.
It's something Trump could do.
If he could, he would. Took Lenin's dead body and placed it in a mausoleum, mummified him, and made him a monument too, but a monument to Stalin's power. And so by the time that the Soviet Union fell, Lenin had been transformed in the minds of most people in the Soviet Union, in Russia, into a symbol of Stalinist power. Now, that was a distortion of what Lenin actually had been, but this was how he was perceived and how his statues were perceived. So that while, from one point of view, it was sad to see the man who had led the first socialist revolution in the world brought down, figuratively speaking, one could certainly understand bringing down of those statues as an aspect of the exercise of popular power, and similarly the renaming of that city.
Bruce, we're coming to an end of our allotted time, and I just wanted to ask you about the new book that you're working on. What's it called, and when's it coming out?
Well, it's tentatively called Thaddeus Stevens, The Making of a Revolutionary. And it's about possibly the most radical of the radical Republican statesmen who governed the United States during the Civil War and the Reconstruction era. I'm not sure when it's going to be published. The manuscript is due to the publisher next spring, and I am endeavoring to get it done by that date. And it tells the story of how this individual, born, by the way, in the most radical of the states of the United States in the 1780s, evolved into the individual we know who fought so hard to bring down the slaveholding aristocracy of the South, and not only to help emancipate the former slaves, but to give them full rights as citizens and to divide the plantation lands of the South among them so that they would have independent economic means with which to sustain themselves. So this is a great hero of mine, and working on this book is, of course, a great labor of love.
Well, Bruce, we're certainly going to open up our microphones to you when that book comes out. We're grateful to you, Bruce Levine, for being on Law and Disorder, and we wish you all the best. Thanks for doing it.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me on, and of course, I wish this wonderful program all the best.
You take it easy. Thanks, Bruce. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss.
John Brown's body lies a-moldering in the grave. John Brown's body lies a-moldering in the grave. John Brown's body lies a-moldering in the grave, but his soul goes marching on. Glory, glory, hallelujah. Glory, glory, hallelujah. Glory, glory, hallelujah. But his soul goes marching on. The stars above in heaven are looking kindly down. The stars above in heaven are looking kindly down. The stars above in heaven are looking kindly down on the grave of old John Brown. Glory, glory, hallelujah. Glory, glory, hallelujah. glory, glory, hallelujah. His soul goes marching on. He captured Harper's Ferry with his 19 men so true. He frightened old Virginia till she trembled through and through. They hanged him for a traitor.
Last week, President Trump pardoned, without him even requesting it, the infamous Joe Arpaio, sheriff of Maricopa County, which includes the heavily Latino community of Phoenix, Arizona. Sheriff Joe was in office for 26 years. Observers have called it a reign of terror. He himself called his jail a concentration camp. He kept prisoners outside in tents with temperatures ranging from 40 degrees to 147 degrees. Prisoners died at an alarming rate, often without explanation. He paraded hundreds of Hispanic prisoners in chains, dressed in black and white stripes, through the streets of Phoenix. Another time, he forced them to wear pink underwear. He was pardoned by President Trump, who praised him lavishly, after a federal judge found Arpaio in contempt of court for ordering his department to arrest people solely because they looked Latino and ignoring a court order to stop. Arpaio was about to be sentenced when Trump stepped in and overrode the judge. Here to speak with us today about the ethical and constitutional implications for the future of Trump's pardon is returning guest Professor Ellen Yaroshevsky. She teaches ethics at the law school at Hofstra University. She's a former staff attorney and later a board member at the Center for Constitutional Rights and a leader of the National Lawyers Guild. Professor Yaroshevsky, welcome back to Law and Disorder.
Thank you, Michael. It's a pleasure to be here.
Well, likewise. It's really good to talk to you, Ellen. Technically, what Trump did in pardoning Sheriff Joe is legal, right? So what do you find objectionable about it?
Well, it's legal. Under the Constitution, the president has the absolute power of pardon. It's one of the few absolute powers given to the president. I mean, that said, it's beyond highly unusual. First of all, we can talk about what Arpaio did that is so offensive to most people throughout the country. But let me just start with the process, okay? So typically, there's an office of pardons. In order to give a pardon, usually, if you had a president who followed norms, who followed procedures, which this president does not, what you do is you go through the office of pardons. And, you know, it's funny because once again, Huckabee, his spokesperson, said, oh, we're going to engage in a thorough and a standard process, and this is anything but. So what you're supposed to do is go through seven different layers of review, an FBI background check, before you even think about a pardon, right? And usually you have to wait 5 years. This is the norm in the Justice Department, the Justice Department regulations. You wait 5 years after a person is convicted before you even think of a pardon, right? So here, first of all, not only didn't they wait 5 years, but he hasn't even been sentenced, right? He hasn't even been sentenced at all. Typically, a pardon is thought of as an admission of guilt, right? And there's certainly no admission of guilt here. And there's usually a request for a pardon. So Trump has violated every single one of those norms. Is that the violation of the law? Not formally. But what's so disgusting about this, and really I would say disgusting, is that you're dealing with a person here who has developed what a police chief called a reign of terror in Arizona, a reign of terror, that for the entire time Arpaio was there, there is a police chief who said on a daily basis, virtually on a daily basis, he and his minions were violating the constitutional rights of various citizens, primarily Latinos in that culture. So what they would do, this is just the basic stuff of what they would do, they'd stop anybody profiling them who looked Latino to check on their documents. You're not entitled to do that. That's a violation of the Constitution. They would follow Latino-looking parents to schools where they dropped their kids off, and then they'd check them for documents. So people became afraid to take their kids to school. All right. So that's just the beginning of the profiling, the way in which they profiled Latinos. Then what he did is when he picked people up, he'd often pick up citizens. He'd pick up citizens, people who had green cards and people who had citizenship, and they'd hold them for 18 to 20 hours in their jail. Right. before they'd ever let anybody go. Totally unconstitutional. Then he set up what's called, he called Tent City, which is their jail, which is an abomination and has been called a concentration camp. And what that was an outdoor tent, an outdoor set jail, 120 degrees in Arizona. People would be outside. They barely got fed. He claimed he gave them breakfast and dinner, but the meals were very, very scant. People lost a lot of weight. And then they would, the abuses that went on there were just legion. So what people might know about, what he became famous for, is making his male prisoners wear pink. Humiliation. Complete humiliation. But what people don't know as well, the number of people who died there, that they didn't take care of people. So there's, for instance, one man who was a paraplegic who was asking for a catheter. And when he asked for a catheter, he got beaten up. They crushed his vocal cord. And then later on, when there was a lawsuit about that, somehow the evidence of his crushed vocal cord disappeared. All right. So this is the kind of thing that went on a daily basis there. People were beaten, and there were many, many reports in the Arizona press and nationally about what Arpaio did. So you have a person that's been described as creating a culture of hate, who's cruel, who's immoral, who engaged in flagrant violations of the law when he was a sheriff. So that's just the beginning of what I find offensive about this.
What was Trump's past relationship with Sheriff Joe?
Well, it's interesting. They met because they were both birthers, which is to say, Arpaio started saying, oh, Obama was born elsewhere. Obama's not a citizen. And Trump was, of course, saying the same thing. And that's the way they met. And then, of course, they share a lot of their political beliefs. So over time, they became friends.
Didn't Trump promise at a rally in Arizona that he was going to pardon him, kind of to stir up the base?
Well, Trump is relying on his base. He doesn't have a lot of support elsewhere in the country. In fact, you know, many, many people who know about his antics and about his lies and about his actions disdain what he's doing as president. So he went to Arizona to, quote, stir up his base. And one of the things interesting about that, there weren't that many people at that rally. You know, the press didn't really report that fully, but in fact, there were many fewer people at that rally than he expected. So yes, he went to the base, and he pardoned Arpaio because of that base. Now, Arpaio does not have the support of the majority of people in Arizona. He did not win his recent election. You know, there aren't that many people who support him. But the people who were at that Trump rally were Arpaio supporters. And so, yes, he went there. You know, it's a Trumpian way of doing things, which is he doesn't really promise, but he promises. He lets people know this is what he's going to do. But he signaled all along that this is what he was going to do. He's going to pardon Arpaio.
What disturbs me is that by doing that, by pardoning Arpaio, he totally undercut a federal court judge. And I wanted to ask you about that and about what Trump's relationship has been with the judiciary.
Well, you may recall that Trump has very little respect for another branch of government. He was calling people so-called judges. A judge of Latino origin with whom he disagreed, called him a so-called judge. So, I mean, this is a man who doesn't understand government to begin with, has no desire to learn anything about government, who's merely out, as Joy Reid has said when she talks about this. He talks about his ratings. He cares about his ratings. He cares about his base, and that's really it. So the idea he would learn how a democracy functions, it's not of interest to him. The only thing of interest to him is his own ego. And so he doesn't have respect for the judiciary. He doesn't understand what the judiciary does, the way in which the judiciary is supposed to check the power of the president and check the power of the legislature. And to the extent to which he disagrees with the judge, he just comes out and he just totally criticizes the judge and won't even acknowledge that the person is actually worthy of being called a judge. So, no, he has absolutely no respect for the judiciary. Of course, I suppose if the judge agreed with him on something, he would say, what a great judge. But in terms of the role itself, you know, the idea that he wouldn't even wait for a judge to sentence somebody is just beyond the pale. You know, look, Arpaio probably wasn't going to get more than 6 months. I mean, that's what contempt of court would lead to. And so the idea you're pardoning someone who hasn't even been sentenced, who might not even get much of a sentence, is pretty shocking.
Yeah, well, it's really a signal, I think, and I wanted to ask you about that. But before I do that, let's talk about the concept of a judge holding somebody in contempt. That's really the only power that a court has, isn't it, to hold somebody in contempt for a violation of a court order?
Well, correct. I mean, what happens here is the judge had a lengthy trial. I mean, this was one of many cases that had been filed against Arpaio. This is a case filed by the American Civil Liberties Union, talking about racial profiling, a violation of the Constitution. The judge held a 7-day hearing, 7 days of a trial, and at the end of 7 days, found that, in fact, Arpaio, through his policies, had violated the Constitution. He was ordered to stop. He was ordered to stop doing this, and he just didn't listen. He didn't care. And so he kept engaging in the violations of the Constitution. And so all a judge can do is say, you are now in contempt of this court's order, and then have a hearing as to whether you're in contempt, and then sentence you based upon that contempt until you cure your contempt. Yeah, so that's all a judge can do at that point.
Talk about the precedent Trump has set by pardoning Joe Arpaio. How does this going to play, for example, with other people that get held in contempt of court? And here I'm thinking about people who might otherwise testify against Trump as a result of the ongoing investigation that Mueller is doing.
Well, there are a lot of people talking about the effect of this this pardon. I mean, the key one right now is what you're talking about, the Mueller investigation. What Mueller's doing is the way federal prosecutors operate, is getting people to cooperate with him. That means you get people to come in to give you information in lieu of being indicted. The rumors are that both Manafort and Flynn, perhaps Flynn, are in there talking to Mueller, giving them information so that they themselves either don't get prosecuted or they may enter into an agreement where they would get prosecuted for less than that which they would otherwise be charged. And so many more people may come forward. I mean, this is a sinking ship, right? It is a sinking ship. There's a lot of information out there. Mueller has a very sophisticated and robust staff of lawyers and investigators who are looking across the board about Russia, about money, about ways in which there are violations of law. So there may be many people sitting there with information saying, look, I don't want to get indicted. I'm going to go in. I'm going to talk to Mueller. Easier to do that than get indicted. If people now know that, wait a minute, I mean, Trump can just come along and pardon me later on. I'm not going to go cooperate with Mueller. Why should I? Because Donald Trump, if I don't cooperate, is more likely to pardon me later on down the road. So, I mean, this may just be speculation, but my view is it sends a signal to everybody who's thinking about cooperation, better to stay with Donald Trump, because at the end of the day, I'm going to get a pardon. If he can pardon Arpaio, he can pardon anybody, all right? So that's one message sent by this, which is obviously very disturbing. I mean, another major message goes to the entire Latino community, which says, we don't give a damn about you. You know, we don't care. We don't care if the sheriff is out there violating your rights. We don't care that a judge said that the sheriff has violated your rights. We're just going to continue to do that. So it's disturbing on a lot of different levels.
Yeah, really disturbing. I mean, having a guy send minorities to a concentration camp, but we know about that. Trump singling him out as an America's greatest sheriff is scary. What about the thought with respect to pardons Trump could pardon himself? He has suggested that. What's your evaluation of that?
A lot of academics have gone back and forth about the pardon power, and they have all investigated the history of the pardon power. And nobody agrees. Some people say, yes, he can pardon himself. Other people say no. You know, it's one of these legal questions for which there's no definitive answer. The reason being, there's no one who sat and formed the Constitution who ever thought, oh, a president's going to pardon himself. It's unthinkable. It is just unthinkable. And so we shall see. It may be that what would happen is he decides to pardon himself. Then that goes, I mean, he has absolute power to do that. Or he will claim, and then it may go to a court for a court to decide, does a president have the absolute power or not? That issue raises so many questions about which is the executive power the most significant one, or is the judicial power the most significant one? So there's no answer to this question, but given the fact the way this man behaves, it wouldn't at all be surprising if he pardons everybody. He pardons Jared, he pardons Ivanka if she's involved, he pardons everyone there, and then he turns around and pardons himself.
Well, that puts him above the law. That makes him a total autocrat.
Well, yes, exactly, but that's the way he is behaving. I mean, much of what's gone on in this administration mirrors the way dictators have behaved over time, the way they amass power, the way they don't care about other branches of government, the way they don't care about the normal ways in which not just the laws operate, but the norms, right? It is not just that he violates the law. It's not just that. You look at the conflicts of interest. You look at the constitutional provisions that prohibit him from making money as a result of being in the presidency, right, about investing in foreign governments, et cetera, right? We've talked a long time about the emoluments clause, about conflicts of interest. There's clear violations along the way. There may be, if Mueller finds, violations of money laundering, of various other federal statutes. But beyond that, it's just the way in which things are normally done, right? Those are called norms. They're not laws. And what's gone on since he's assumed office, is he's just violated everything we take for granted, every norm. It's shameful.
Speaking of norms, Joe Arpaio would go after people who criticized him in Phoenix. If a reporter wrote a story against him, he'd go after him. That's the same kind of pattern that Trump has exhibited.
Well, they're very similar. He was called the Donald Trump of Arizona. This is in Maricopa County. So yes, he went after the press. He went after the press. He ends up suing the press. That case, of course, got dismissed. But no, he has no shame whatsoever. It's all about him. It's all about violations of law. It's all about suppressing Latinos. And what's really interesting is, you know, he was elected so many times. He's elected six times. And you might say, like, how is that possible when these issues appeared in the press regularly? It's not as if Arizonans did not know about this. There were many, many lawsuits. I mean, the citizenry of Arizona paid out something like $140 million during the time he's been sheriff in damages to individuals who have sued and claimed that their rights were violated, and they win jury verdicts, okay? So the citizens of Arizona are paying all that money, and nevertheless, he continues to get elected. And it wasn't until the Latinos, the undocumented workers, basically rose up and said, no more. We are not hiding anymore. We are not doing this. They began to organize. They lost their fear, which is really amazing and a very difficult thing. Imagine being an undocumented person who's being targeted by the sheriff. Imagine engaging in organizing with others. But they did that, and they did that over a period of time. And that's ultimately what led to his ouster. So that in 2016... and I think it was his sixth re-election, 57% of voters said that they would not vote for him,
yeah.
That they recognized that he was really unfair.
That's a landslide. In political science terms, more than 5% is a landslide. Well, good for them.
Well, especially in Arizona. I mean, it's becoming more democratic precisely because there are more Latinos there. But traditionally, I mean, think of it, it's the home of people from the north who go down there to retire. It is a very white, a very conservative place. Older folks, and that's where the base came from. That's how he got so much support over time. But, you know, people are, many people, there are law-abiding citizens. And when they watched what Sheriff Joe did over time, you know, you just can't continue to violate the law. Even if they were racist, the voters, you just can't continue to violate the law. I mean, at one point, I can go on and on about the things he did because they're alleged in all of these lawsuits. And I encourage other people who are listening, if they're interested, to go online and read the ACLU lawsuit. It's online. Read some of the articles about his conduct. But at some point, he hired a private investigator to investigate the judge. in his case. He was going after the judge. He wanted to find dirt on the judge. Then the court had ordered him to turn over a hard drive in his computer, and they tried to destroy the hard drive. It was supposed to be sent to the court. I mean, these are the kinds of things that went on that were reported in the press. And over time, I think people just recognized no more.
Is the pardon all she wrote here, or are there further legal proceedings that are going on subsequent to the pardon?
What's going on now, which is really interesting, is once somebody's pardoned, there's no case anymore, right? But the judge in Arizona hasn't just outright dismissed this case. I mean, she has a case before her about to sentence somebody, and what she did was she ordered both sides to submit briefs about the case, about what the pardon power means here. You know, it's unclear what she has in mind, but one of the issues here is that a pardon is generally thought of as an admission of guilt. Many people have been pardoned over time. One of the reasons Reagan, by the way, wouldn't pardon Ollie North, who had engaged in the Iran-Contra, was he thought it would look as if he was guilty, because that's the understanding, that a pardon really admits that you're guilty and now we're going to excuse you. So the judge may be doing something about the notion of is Arpaio admitting guilt or not by being pardoned. I really don't know. I don't know that anybody knows what she has in mind at this point. But it's a very interesting development that just happened.
And Trump is defending his action by saying that Obama pardoned Chelsea Manning.
Yes, I know. But, you know, think about Chelsea Manning. Poor Chelsea Manning served 7 years. 7 years of hard time, right? A very different set of circumstances. This man was not even sentenced yet, hadn't served a day. That's even notwithstanding comparing what Chelsea Manning did with what Arpaio did. I mean, many people will argue what Chelsea Manning did was a service to the country.
I would say
it
so.
Was not about right. It was not about abusing the rights of citizenry. So, but I'm just saying, even if you don't want to argue about the difference between the underlying crimes that they're convicted of, the very fact is that Chelsea Manning already served 7 years. And they went through an entire lengthy process, you know, of seven layers of command and FBI checks and many, many conferences considering, do we pardon this person or not? What are the consequences? So just on a procedural basis, you just can't compare the two. It's yet another Trumpian piece of news that just doesn't hold water.
Yeah, the one that's more comparable, I think, is the pardon of Mark Rich. The wealthy banker.
The Bill Clinton one?
His wife was a big contributor to the Democratic Party. That was a sleazy
exactly.
move, just like this one. I think that's more comparable than Chelsea Manning.
Mark Rich, that might be sleazy. Clinton may have pardoned a bunch of people, and everyone was aghast. But Mark Rich, yes, was done for political reasons. What Arpaio did here is so disgusting. It's to promote a culture of hate, to be that cruel, to be that flagrant. To me, there really isn't a comparison to what Clinton did.
You know, I agree. Listen, before we let you go, Ellen Yaroshevsky, we had you on the show a couple months ago because you were one of a number of lawyers who filed an ethics complaint down in D.C. And I'd like you to please rehash what you did, why you did it, and if there's any change since you filed the complaint.
Yes, sure. Well, there are 15 legal ethicists, that is, people who are engaged in looking at the conduct of lawyers. Lawyers are bound by a code of professional responsibility called the Rules of Professional Conduct. And Kellyanne Conway, who was called counselor to Donald Trump and was hired to advise and counsel him about policies, is a lawyer. She's a lawyer in Washington, D.C. She's a lawyer admitted there and in New Jersey. And we looked at her notation that there's such a thing as alternative facts, right, which are not facts at all but are lies and misrepresentations. And we looked at a series of comments that she made in the press over time, lies about Obama, lies about the so-called Bowling Green massacre. You may recall that. And we were very disturbed that a lawyer who's supposed to have integrity, a lawyer that's supposed to make truthful statements, that a lawyer would do that. And there's an ethics rule that prohibits lawyers from engaging in conduct involving dishonesty, deceit, fraud and misrepresentation, and we believed it was our duty as lawyers to file a complaint against her. And so we did that. We filed a lengthy complaint. You can find it online. And the result so far has been that D.C. recently, in July, actually acknowledged that they received the complaint. But that's all that has happened thus far. Now, it's unusual because she wasn't, quote, practicing law in the traditional sense. And so many ethicists would say, well, lawyers shouldn't, even if she's a lawyer, she shouldn't be bound by those rules unless she's actually practicing law. But that's not what the rule says. The rule holds lawyers' feet to the fire because we don't want lawyers out there in the culture just lying the way that she does. So we shall see.
Well, we're going to check back with you, Ellen Yaroshevsky, about the Kellyanne Conway case and about any future developments with Sheriff Joe and Trump's pardoning of him. And we're very grateful to have you as a guest on Law and Disorder. Thanks for being on.
It's a pleasure. Thank you so much, Michael.
You take it easy.
Okay, thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
If you want to hear Law and Disorder again, go to lawanddisorder.org on the web. You should also go to Law and Disorder Radio on Facebook.